You never know what to expect when a man introduces you in a lectureship. You don't know if he's going to pick on you or not. Burnett was Dub's hometown for a long time. I don't know if they've recovered yet, but if you want more details, I have his Aunt Maud's address with me. And I must say, I was awfully glad to see my catcher this morning. I talked to him about a week ago, and he said, "Now, you be sure and be there at 9. I'm going to drive down Monday morning, so you be sure and be there in case I'm late." And I was awful glad to see you, Mike, wherever you are. I am thankful to be able to be here, and I appreciate very much the confidence expressed by the elders in the invitation to speak. And I would like to stress to the members of the congregation here, I know that many are not here because they have to work, but I hope that you understand what a tremendous good work you're doing for the brotherhood in this congregation and how far-reaching the effects of it are. It is indeed a great blessing to all of us. The book of Esther, as Mike so ably pointed out, is a unique book. The name of God is nowhere mentioned within the sacred pages of Esther. We meet in the second chapter, really the star of the book, the young woman whose name in Hebrew is Hadassah, Esther, as we know her, the queen of all of Persia. She was, in fact, the cousin of Mordecai, who was an older cousin, evidently, raised her as an orphaned child, and she grew to become the wife of the man who at that point in time was the most powerful man in the world, Ahasuerus. In chapter 2, as Michael pointed out just at the last moment, Mordecai was able, through some intelligence that he came into possession of, to save the life of the king. And that significantly sets the stage for the outcome of the biggest part of the book, as it's revealed in chapters 6 and 7. In chapters 2 and 3, three and 4, the section which is assigned to me, we meet the final one of the cast of characters in this great book, Haman, an Amalekite of great influence in the kingdom of Persia. Haman, it turns out, is one of history's most despicable villains. His savagery toward the Jews, towards God's people, was precipitated and activated altogether by Mordecai's determination that he's not going to do anything that will compromise his faith before God. He intends to stay pure before God, and that determination brought upon him potentially great affliction from Haman. Before we come to the end of these two great chapters, we're going to see this dreadful man set in motion a scheme that would rival in its savagery, in its scope, and its intensity, even Hitler's so-called final solution. Mordecai will take determinate action against it, and Esther, the godly queen of Persia, will show herself to be a woman of great integrity and enormous personal courage in the face of terrible danger. Now, I would like this morning for us to look, as quickly as I can do it, at the 7 paragraphs of these 2 chapters. And then after we hopefully very quickly review them, we'll note the great lessons that they contain for us. Turn, if you would, to Esther chapter 3, and we'll begin with verses 1 through 6, which are the first paragraph of this chapter. Here we meet the terrible villain, Haman himself. He is an Amalekite, the son of Hammedatha, termed an Agagite. Of course, Agag, the great king of the Amalekites, this does not, according to most of the Bible scholars, indicate that Haman was of royal lineage. It's possible, but it's not necessary. His name means alternately well-disposed or magnificent and splendid, and certainly from the promotion that King Ahasuerus gave him, the king evidently thought that he was a splendid fellow, a wonderful sort of guy. We don't really know why the king promoted him. The details are not given. But whatever the reason, whether it was through some good work that he had done, which to us at least seems unlikely, or simply because he'd managed to pull some strings, it becomes quickly obvious that Haman was a man of high, high hopes and low, low standards. And so probably he pulled whatever strings he could to secure the promotion. He was made what we would call the grand vizier of the entire kingdom. He had authority over everyone else. His position was one of great prominence. He was essentially second only to the king himself. We read in verse 2 of a new perk that accompanied his promotion. He was to have the homage, the honor of all the peoples. What is significant about this and what precipitated Mordecai's action is the fact that the word there that's translated bowed down, which means what the people did toward him to show their honor for him, is the Hebrew word kara. And it means not just to bow down or to pay honor as to a civil authority, but rather it means to bow down as in worship to God. But here, that kind of reverence is to be shown to Haman. Well, naturally, Mordecai could not do that without compromising his faith in God. Neither God's laws nor the customs of the Hebrews would have prevented him from bowing down as a symbol or an indication of honor to a civil authority. But for him to have bowed down to Haman in this fashion would have indicated that he was giving to Haman, a mere man and an ungodly man at that, what rightfully belongs only to Almighty God. Now the Persians of that day believed that their king was divine. Their beliefs were a lot like those of the Egyptians of earlier years. They believed that the king was a manifestation of God in the flesh. And so it would have been unmistakable in the circumstances what bowing down to Haman would have implied, because his honor was to be that of the king. Furthermore, we read in Exodus chapter 17, in verses 8 through 16, the root of another problem here. The Amalekites were the ancient enemies of God's people. There they had attacked God's people, evidently without provocation at Rephidim, had been repulsed, had been sorely defeated as Moses, with the assistance of two of his generals, held up his staff above his head, and the people prevailed over them. Surely it would have vexed Mordecai sorely to have had to bow down and give homage to a representative of such a wicked people. Did he sin by refusing to bow down before Haman? Absolutely not. But he did, unquestionably, violate the king's commandment. There was no question as far as his fellow servants were concerned. They simply looked for some reasonable explanation as to why he would break the law. His refusal to bow down must have been quite obvious to them. And so he appeared to be very contemptuous, both of Haman and, by extension, contemptuous of the king as well. They wanted some reasonable explanation. The only explanation he would give them is, "I'm a Jew." And that should have been enough said for them. If they knew the history, they'd know the reasoning that he was using. Here we find what a delicate balance is struck between wrath and reason in verse 5. Haman is outraged that this Jew would not bow down to him. He was enjoying the adulation and the honor and the homage of all the peoples, and here's Mordecai reigning on his parade. What Haman felt was not merely anger. It was not just annoyance, but rather it was unbridled rage. His reason gave way to revenge. He wanted to precipitate wanton slaughter in order to avenge himself on Mordecai. We see also here the power of Satan. He removed all sensible restraints from the heart and mind of Haman and caused him to seek the blood of innocent people to satisfy his anger. And this also, by the way, would have wiped out the bloodline of the Savior had it come to pass. Thanks be to God, it did not. Now in paragraph number 2, in verses 7 through 11, we find the details. We have the time of the event. Verse 7 indicates that this occurred in late March or perhaps early April. If the events of verses 7 through 12 all occurred on the same day, and it seems at least to me reasonable that they did, then this plot materialized on the day before Passover. The irony of such timing surely could not have escaped Mordecai. The great feast of Passover was upon them, that which commemorated God's deliverance of his people from Egyptian bondage. And surely, Mordecai believed that if God had done it once, he'd do it again. Secular history dates the reign of this king, Ahasuerus, as beginning approximately 483 BC. So the dates of this chapter occurred evidently about 474 BC. Now the Persians were a very superstitious people. They trusted firmly in astrology. And Haman's decision then led them to cast lots together, he and his friends, to try and eliminate unlucky and ill-omened days on which to carry out his plot. Verse 13 shows that their chosen date seems to be exactly 11 months in the future. Because of his position as the Grand Vizier, or whatever you want to call him, the Prime Minister of Persia, Haman might have been able to get away with having Mordecai executed summarily and not have had any repercussions from it. But his plan was far grander than that. He wanted to obliterate the nation of the Jews, all to get even with Mordecai. And so he couldn't do that on his own. That would require the king's permission. And so what did he do? In verse 8, we see that he used a calculated lie to persuade the king to give his approval to this dreadful scheme. There was indeed a grain of truth in what he had to say. Indeed, the laws of the Jews were different than the laws of the king. But these who had remained behind after Cyrus had released the captive some 100 plus years before had not become rebels and dissidents, but rather they were prosperous, hardworking, faithful citizens of the king. He had nothing to lose, nothing to gain by destroying them, and much to lose, as we'll see just a moment ago. What Haman proposed would have brought about a very noticeable effect on the king's revenues. F.C. Cook quotes from the historian Herodotus to the effect that the king's income in that period equaled about 14,500 talents of silver annually. We don't know how Haman proposed to alleviate this loss of income. But we do know that he proposed to make up almost two-thirds of it in order to compensate the king for the destruction of the Jews. Whether he was going to do it out of his own pocket or from the spoils of those whom he would kill is not clear and doesn't really matter. The point is that this equaled, as Winters estimates, about 375 tons of silver, which at the current market price of about 3 months ago, maybe it was 4 months ago, works out to over $47 million. That's a lot of money before inflation. In verse 10, we see the tremendous power of Haman's evil influence. He is able to persuade the king to lend him his signet ring. Now, the signet was used to authenticate written documents by the king. It made possible Haman's scheme. It gave the king's stamp of approval, quite literally, to what Haman proposed to do. And it also, by the way, then transferred responsibility from Haman to the king himself, because this gave the king's permission to all that was commanded. In verse 11, we find that the king evidently waived any right to the spoils of Haman's plan, and that then gave Haman the means to offer an incentive to the other peoples to destroy the Jews. Take their land, take their goods, take their property, and it'll be worth your while to kill them, man, woman, and child. Now look to paragraph 3, the last of chapter 3, in verses 12 through 15. Note the detail given here in the Bible record. This is not vague, but very specific. We have given to us the exact date on which the plot would come to pass. We find the names of the precise parties involved. We have the fact given to us that the decree was published in all of the various languages of the different peoples of the 127 provinces of the king. And we find that all was done by the authorization of the king himself. Here we determine that this heinous plan evidently came into existence on the eve of Passover. Leviticus chapter 23 verse 5 sets that date at the 14th day of Nisan, which is the first month of the Hebrew year, according to verse 7. The destruction date that was set was the 13th day of Adar, which is the 12th month of the year, in verse 13. Evidently, the Jews had 11 months forewarning. Why was there so much lead time? There are two possibilities. Number one, with that much warning published abroad, these people would naturally begin to flee for their lives. And that would cause them to have to leave behind much property and much goods that Haman then could simply come along and confiscate without a fight. But further, and perhaps more likely, is the fact that Haman was a good Persian. He was one who trusted in astrology. And having eliminated what he believed to be the unlucky days for his plot, and found a date that he felt was suitably fixed, perhaps it never even occurred to him that some might escape. His plan went far beyond the normal cruelties of that day. Ordinarily, women and children were thought to be prime captives, a prime part of the loot and plunder and spoil. But Haman wanted them destroyed. Where they would ordinarily be sold into slavery, he wanted valuable property wiped out. And their neighbors then needed an incentive to do that. As we mentioned, Haman found it in the promise of plunder and spoil. Notice in verse 15, he's like a little child. Once his plan has come into existence, he's in a hurry. He's in a rush to get it into motion. And so he sends out the king's messengers in haste. Secular authorities and archaeological studies indicate that the Persian postal system was quite effective and that it was possible to send a message from one side of the Persian Empire to the other in about 3 weeks' time. And so he sends the king's messengers out like the Pony Express, as fast as they can go. Naturally, the word came first to the inhabitants of the capital city of Shushan. They were quite surprised. The decree bore the king's authorization. Perhaps they didn't even know who was actually behind the matter. I believe chapter 4 indicates that the mass of the population did not. But they were nonetheless quite surprised by the wording of this document. Now look to paragraph number 4, and let's hurry along. In the first three verses of chapter 4, we find the reaction of the Jews to this decree. Verse 3 calls it the king's decree. In verse 1, we see Mordecai, having read it, having learned the details of it, going and clothing himself in sackcloth, which, as Michael pointed out, as Brother Music, I believe, pointed out last night, was a dark, hairy clothing, quite uncomfortable sounding, and covering themselves with ashes. Mordecai went out into the streets and bewailed the fate of his people. And we note in verse 3 that as word comes to each province, his countrymen do likewise. And a great wailing and mourning goes up before God. But notice also, and this is very important, and we need to learn this practice well, Mordecai took the time to investigate this decree before making an outcry. The ashes and the wailing and the sackcloth in verse 2 emphasize to everyone the gravity of his distress. This was not some light matter, but a matter of life and death, a matter of great mourning. Mordecai probably had no access to his cousin Esther. She was, after all, the wife of the king. Perhaps, as some authorities indicate, she was kept in a harem, secluded. And so he contacts her in effectively the only means he has to go out where word of his behavior could not escape her hearing. Out in the public, before the gates of the palace, for all to see. In the second paragraph of chapter 4, paragraph number 5 of this text, in verses 4 through 8 now, we find that Esther, receiving word of his mourning, sends him clothing. The custom of the day was to shelter or seclude the sovereign from any sign of mourning, because it was thought that that perhaps would cause him to mourn, which would be a dreadful ill omen for the kingdom. And so naturally, Mordecai would not be allowed to enter into the presence of the king or even into the king's house while in mourning. So Esther sends him some clothing. Perhaps that way he can enter in. But he refuses it. And that to her bespeaks some terrible disaster that has come upon him. Notice, he chose a very public place to bewail the wrongdoing of Haman so that all might know of it. He did not keep silent. He did not simply talk it up among his countrymen, as we are sometimes wont to do among the saints concerning the problems and the trials that come upon us. But he made a public outcry over this dreadful matter. We also see here that Mordecai knew all the details. He didn't know simply the general outline. He had gotten all of the facts. He knew whose idea it was. He knew the exact amount involved. The emphasis here in the Hebrew is on the monetary amount, which stresses the urgency of Haman, the anticipation of carrying out his terrible scheme. Mordecai probably copied this decree down for himself and thus sent a copy word for word so that the queen might know exactly what was done. This is important for us to learn. We need, as we deal with truth and error, to get the facts. One of the things that I appreciate so much about Brother Music's great book, Behold the Pattern, is that the sad and discouraging things that are written therein are documented piece by piece. Brethren, read it if you have not. It's not pleasant, but we need to know it. Mordecai knew, as he proposed to Esther his plan to counteract Haman's plan, the great risk that was involved for her. But he also believed that the risk, the goal was worth the risk. He didn't hesitate to tell her, "Go in and make request for your people." Commentators differ on whether or not the king even knew that she was a Jewess. Adam Clark believes that Haman had learned that she was. And thus, when she says, "It's been 30 days since the king sent for me," Clark believed that this was by Haman's design. That's neither here nor there. But Mordecai said, "Make request for your people," and showed her thus plainly the personal interest that she had in this matter. In paragraph number 6, in verses 9 through 12, we find perhaps the root of her hesitation. The king surely had taken precautions against assassination. This was quite common among the potentates and sovereigns of that day. One who entered the royal presence unsummoned and without being acknowledged hazarded his life. Surely the guards had orders to kill unless there was a word of stay from the sovereign, lest he himself be assassinated. The commentator Kyle of Kyle and Delitzsch points out that it's very possible that Esther could have announced herself and thus avoided this hazard, stood at the door and begged leave to enter into the presence of the king. But in order to do so, he says she probably would have had to state her business, and had Haman been in the presence of the king, that surely would have tipped him off. And remember, he was the king's privy counselor. He had the king's ear, even more so perhaps than the queen. And so, like Moses at the burning bush of Exodus chapter 3 and verse 11, Queen Esther here essentially asks, "Well, what can I do about it? How can I do anything about this?" In the last paragraph now, in verses 13 through 17, Mordecai points out to his cousin that as the queen, Esther might escape Haman's plan, but if she did nothing, she could not escape the wrath of God. In verse 14, he told her that if she held her peace, God would raise up deliverance from another quarter. In essence, he was saying, as James would so many years later in James chapter 4 and verse 17, "You know to do good, and if you do not do it, it is sin." Some important points to note at this juncture. We often fail as children of God in the duties that are set before us, not through lack of action, but through the wrong action. Esther had a specific action to take, and any other would not have been of any avail. Further, as children of God, it's been said and well said, and brethren, some of our liberal brethren are making this point, and we need to heed it. Many times we do not talk the gospel to our neighbors and friends, and we need to. Let us not hesitate to speak up for God. And let us remember, when we keep silent about the faith, we personally, I am hindering the growth of God's kingdom. Inaction carries a penalty.
And we don't want to forget that fact. In Luke chapter 12, verses 4 and 5, the Lord says, "Don't fear the one who can kill the body, but fear the one who can cast the soul into hell." And if we are not active, that is our fate. Mordecai plainly believed that Esther had come into her position of prominence and grace and power for this moment exactly, to intercede for her people. And further, he surely believed that if she did not, she would sin. Those then are the seven paragraphs of Esther chapters 3 and 4, with just a few brief facts that go along with them. Now let's quickly, before time runs out, try to draw out some of the great lessons found in these two chapters. Lesson number one, let us look to the example of Mordecai as one who would do nothing that would compromise his faith. Verse 2. To obey the king's command would put him in the position, as we stated a moment ago, of giving to Haman, of all people, what rightfully belonged to God. Remember that Hebrew word, kara. He could not bow down and pay homage and do obeisance to Haman as he would to a god without being guilty effectively of idolatry. Now the great temptation to many of us in our generation is that we go along. Elders are oftentimes tempted to go along with the demands of a few old soreheads in the congregation, rather than stand firmly for the truth. It's amazing the pressure that one or two unhappy people can put on godly elders. We are oftentimes tempted to simply lay down the sword, shut the mouth, keep quiet in the face of the onslaught of some of our liberal brethren, those of the Tulsa Workshop and the Jubilee and other such activities, because their numbers seem ready to overwhelm us. But let us not compromise our faith. The pressure of our peers does not stop when we pass our majority and cease to be children. It is an experience for all of us and for all of life. I believe it was in Brother Paul Sain's bulletin from East Hill in Pulaski, Tennessee, that I recently read the little story of a faithful child of God, one of whose co-workers invited him to put a dollar in the betting pool at work, I think the story goes. And he said, "No, I'd prefer not to. I don't gamble." And the man said to him, "Well, let me just put a dollar in for you." And he said, "No, I don't want to even be associated with what I believe is wrong." And the man said to him, "I knew you wouldn't. I knew you believed that way. I just wanted to see if you'd go along with it, if you'd let me carry you along." That man stood for the Lord and for what was right without even realizing the impact of what he was about to do. And so should we. Long ago, in Exodus 23 and verse 2, the Lord God through the Spirit said, "Thou shalt not follow after a multitude to do evil. Neither shalt thou speak in a cause to turn aside after a multitude to wrest justice." We cannot just go along, but must stand for what is true. Just so Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 15 and 16, "Let none of you suffer as a murderer, or a thief, or an evildoer, or as a meddler in other men's matters. But if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf." Let us never, ever, even consider doing anything that will cause us to compromise our faith. Let us buy the truth and sell it not for any price. Proverbs 23, verse 23. Next, lesson number two, let us point out that standing for the faith always has a price. Michael made this point very well in the last hour, and we want to touch it once again. As Brother Music pointed out last night in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12, many times when we're not suffering persecution as Christians, it's because we're not standing for the faith. It's said of Peter and John in Acts chapters 4 and 5, when they were tried for the faith, that they would not bend, they would not bow, and thus they did not break. And such should be our determination. To follow after the example of these godly men, after the example of Mordecai, who unflinchingly stood his ground at great personal risk and danger. Hazards are often inherent in trying to live uprightly before God. It just goes with the territory, brethren. We read in Hebrews chapter 11 of the great heroes of the faith, many of whom even gave up their lives for the truth. We need to make great men and women like these our heroes. Men like Stephen, who even with his dying breath gave honor and glory to the God of heaven. Jesus spoke of setting family members one against another in Luke chapter 12, 51 through 53. Some of you have experienced this very thing for the sake of the gospel. There are further many occupations that clash with the essence of Christian living. Two examples come to mind in the liquor and the tobacco industries. In many more occupations and pastimes, we might be pressured to compromise Christian values for the sake of profit or perhaps job security. And then too, many people simply cannot live righteously unless they're ready to put off the socially accepted sins of the flesh. In Mark chapter 6, verses 17 and following, Jesus speaks of unlawful marriages. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, we read of various sins of the flesh. And we cannot inherit the kingdom of heaven unless we put off those things. It's as simple as that. But perhaps the greatest hazard for many of us is the temptation that so many of our liberal brethren have given into to ease off on the standards of God. To back off and not make an issue of some of the things God has plainly said are an issue. And that's surely the source of most of the troubles among brethren today. That may ease the discomfort that some folks feel. My goodness, is he coming up here already? I'm not even halfway through. It may ease the discomfort of some in sin, but it cannot be done without incurring the wrath of God. John 3 and verse 36 plainly says, "He that believeth on the Son hath eternal life, but he that obeyeth not the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abideth on him." Let's point out quickly, number 3, that faith and conviction can rise to conquer fear and danger. When Mordecai chose not to bow, he knew that he was putting his life on the line. He probably knew what kind of man Haman was. But nevertheless, he was true to his convictions, just as Daniel and Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael were in Daniel chapters 1, 3, and 6, when they hazarded their lives for the truth. Also, the life of Esther was at danger in going into the king unsummoned. She was not exempt from the law. She was quite fearful, as verse 11 indicates, and yet she did not hesitate but a moment. Jesus plainly said in Mark chapter 12, verse 30, "He that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth." Our commitment to Christ is measured day by day in the choices we make. We can stand up for Jesus, as the psalm says, or we can, with many of our liberal brethren, sit in the seat of the scornful, Psalm 1:1. Joshua challenged Israel in the long ago to choose this day whom you will serve. And we make that choice every day of our lives. Lesson number 4. We see the depths of destruction reached by pride. Solomon wrote, as Michael quoted a moment ago, in Proverbs 16:18, "Pride goeth before a fall, and a haughty spirit before destruction." Haman is a perfect example of how pride brings a man down. It warped and destroyed what judgment he had. He was like Ahab in 1 Kings 21. Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard. He couldn't have it. And it just nearly tore him up because he had all of his hopes fixed on one thing. So did Haman. When his pride was denied, what did he do but seek to strike out and destroy the object of his rage? Let us therefore recall the critical value of self-control. By it we obtain our salvation. Lesson number 5, we should simply term act on the fact. When Haman's decree was published, Mordecai did not act until he had all the facts in hand. He took the time to investigate, but once he had the facts, he did not hesitate to take decisive action in chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. We need to follow his example. Brethren, harm and sorrow have come from the hastily conceived actions of ill-informed brethren. Paul counseled Timothy in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 22, "Lay hands hastily on no man. Be not partaker of other men's sins. But by the same token, when we have the facts, let us not sit on them, but take action promptly and immediately." Let us act on the fact and not delay to do what's right. We have to redeem the time, Ephesians 5, verse 16, "For the days are evil." As we seek to act for the right, let us make a point of standing up publicly for what is right. Mordecai chose the most public place available to bewail the sin of Haman. We as saints ought to plead the case of Christianity much more publicly than we do. Secular thinking says faith and life must be separate. Put your religion in a pigeonhole over here and leave us alone with it. But the Christian faith must saturate every side of our lives. Paul said, "I have believed and therefore did I speak, and so must we." 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 13. How much time have I got, Deb? 1 minute. Well, let's see if I can cover three more things in 1 minute. Lesson number 7. Righteousness bears a reward. Mordecai and Esther didn't know what their reward would be in this world, but they knew what it would be in eternity. And God blessed them here as well. In chapter 8, verse 1, we see that Esther received the household and the goods of Haman. And Mordecai, in verse 2 of chapter 8, became the overseer of those things. God exalts the righteous. In Proverbs 14, verse 34, righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And he blesses those, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 14, who suffer for doing right. The Lord said, "I'm with you always, even to the end of the world," Matthew 28 and verse 20. And let us not forget that fact. Lesson number 8, let's point to the providence of God. Mordecai was confident that God would deliver his people, verse 14. "Salvation shall arise," he said. We know, Paul wrote to the Romans, that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to his purpose. Let's walk by faith and not by sight, and trust in the promises of God rather than lean on our own understanding. Lesson number 9, let's see if I can squeeze it in. Are you available to God? One of the greatest qualities any person can have is willingness to serve God. Sometimes men want to show a willing heart without actually having one, as the second son of Jesus' parable in Matthew chapter 21, verse 20 illustrates. But Esther was available to God when Mordecai called upon her. There are great and important lessons in this chapter for every child of God. Brethren, let us go and preach them and teach them and uphold them as the truth. God's name never appears, but the book is saturated with his presence. Mordecai and Haman are ideal illustrations of life with and without God. The man who walks with God is humble and holy and happy, and the man that walks without God is edgy and egocentric and evil. Let's follow Mordecai's lead. Learn greater skill in God's word, greater love for the lost, and greater faith in the face of trial. And then we too, as Esther and Mordecai, can stand as eloquent examples of what God's people should be. Confident, faithful, disciplined, committed to God, prayerful, humble, and bold with his word. Thank you.